Thank you, Jake. I want to teach you all a new gathering song this morning.
Right.
It's number 389 if you want to look at it, or you can just sing back what I sing if you want to do it that way. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour. Now your turn.
Gathered here in one strong body.
Gathered here in the spirit and the struggle and the power.
Gathered here in the struggle and the power.
Spirit, draw near.
Spirit, draw near.
Let's sing it. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour. Gathered here in one strong body. Gathered here in the struggle and the power. Spirit, draw near. Thank you. Yes, we are gathered here in one strong body. The embodiment of a community of justice, a community of vision, a community of love. You are welcome here this morning, whoever you are, wherever you come from, whatever you believe, whoever you love. This month our theme is embodiment, and we strive to embody the values we profess. If we are to be a community of justice, we must do justice. If we're to be a community of vision, we must see clearly. If we're to be a community of love, we must practice that love by giving it away. I invite you now to enact our value of hospitality by welcoming one another, especially anyone you do not already know. Okay, I have a special welcome this morning for the Reverend Richard Gehring, our guest speaker this morning, co-pastor of the Manhattan Mennonite Church. He's here because of a couple of converging factors. One, our strategic planning committee has been exploring options for increasing and improving the space we have, and there's a feasibility study for expansion here, and we're exploring possibilities of moving, and one idea that came forth was the idea of shared space with the Mennonites. So nothing was decided, nothing even clearly proposed yet on any of this. We're living in ambiguities and uncertainties, our favorite place to live, right? But in the meantime, we thought it would be good to get to know our Mennonite neighbors better. And at the same time, somehow mysteriously, as if there were psychic forces going on or something, the Sunday Services Committee said, we should have a Mennonite come and tell us about themselves. And so here we are, welcoming Richard this morning to, if nothing else, get to know something more about our Mennonite neighbors. And we welcome some of them as well who are here. So at this time, I'll welcome Mia to come forward and light our chalice. Our prophets died for the freedom of faith. We are here in their spirit. We are here to practice and sustain our living tradition. To light a chalice, claiming for justice the heat and power of fire. In our free faith, we are here seeking freedom from despair, the freedom to be loved as ourselves, and the freedom to grow beyond imagination. We are here, gathered in the name of all that we find holy. Let us give thanks for the gift of gathering here. I invite you to rise in body or spirit as we sing opening hymn number 276, O Young and Fearless Prophet. one of the ways that we forge community is to know something of one another's lives so that we can offer the sympathy, consolation, and congratulations that others need. At this time in our service, we welcome you to share the joys and sorrows, the milestones of your life and of those close to you, so that we can connect with your journey. Raise your hand so that the mic will come to you. That's like it's a magic thing. Raise your hand and the mic will come to you. Well, it is kind of magic. So that all of us can hear and recognize you.
I have a joy. It's good omen. I was burning brush at the temple, but apparently there was a family of rats living in the brush. And one of them came out of the brush pile, bounded up to me, looked at me. He wasn't but here to the chair there, and then bounded off to the bushes. I'm like, I'm wondering if that's a good omen or not. But I was like, huh. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world, and I think that's a good omen for everybody. So.
My brother-in-law, Rod Osland, is recuperating from a double bypass surgery in Salina.
Hello, I'm Emily. We've had a very eventful couple of weeks, my husband and I, Rob and I. He was able to join the folks that went to the science march in Washington, D.C. And then I had a drama therapy conference, which was very exciting. And I have a start date for working at the Stone House. And we have a closing date for buying a home in the area. So we've just had a lot of really positive things happening. Wanted to share that.
Let me follow on with positive. I'd like to thank everybody who generously donated personal care items for the crisis center and the shelter. I'm packaging them up to take them, but for your information, there were 396 items plus a big box of toddler pull-ups and a big bottle of laundry soap. So thank you all.
In the words of Frederick Gillis, we are part of a web of life that makes us one with all humanity, one with the universe. We are grateful for the miracle of consciousness that we share, the consciousness that gives us the power to remember, to love, to care. May we remember, love, and care for the expressions that we have heard here today. And now, wonderful. No? Oh, okay. And it didn't get canceled. Okay. No special music. In that case, I'll invite the children forward for the story for all ages. Good morning. Is that all? It looked like there were more children out there. Okay, so today we have a guest speaker that our adults are going to listen to, who is from the Mennonite Church, and the Mennonites are one of many kinds of Christians, and so they pay very close attention to the teachings of Jesus. So I thought I'd share a little bit about teachings of Jesus with you, and there are so many to choose from. But I thought I would talk a little bit about about the kingdom of heaven. What do you think the kingdom of heaven is? No answer at all? What?
I think it's heaven.
You think it's heaven, okay. And what would that be? No ideas? Well, some people think about the kingdom of heaven as being a place that people go after they die. But other people talk about the kingdom of heaven as being a place, or really not so much a place as a spirit of being able to be connected with God and being connected with one another. Excuse me. And some people also call that beloved community. So Jesus said a whole lot of things about the kingdom of heaven. So I thought I'd share a few of them. One of them is that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. This is a mustard seed. You want to pass it around? What do you notice about a mustard seed?
It's nothing.
It's nothing. Well, it's a seed. And I think when Jake said it's nothing, it means it's really little. And so he said this is a little tiny seed, the tiniest seed that there is, but what do you think happens if you plant it? It grows into a huge bush that all the birds can nest in. So he said the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Uh-huh. He also said the kingdom of heaven is like yeast. What's yeast? Huh? Yeast is bacteria. Can you say a little bit more about what yeast is, though? It's a particular kind. What does it do? It expands. It helps bread grow. So he said it was like yeast that you stir in the flour, and it's not just the yeast that grows up. The whole bread rises. So that's another thing that he said about the kingdom of heaven. He also said the kingdom of heaven was like a treasure that's buried in a field, and somebody sells all they own to buy the field. So that was another thing he said about the kingdom of heaven. What on earth might that mean? These parables are tough, aren't they? They're hard to wrap your head around. It has a hidden value. So there's a hidden value there somehow. And another thing that he said was like that the kingdom of heaven was like a pearl of great price, and the merchant sold a bunch of his gems so that he could buy this one pearl that was so special. What might that mean about the kingdom of heaven? You'd give up a lot to get it. Give up a lot to get it. And finally, I want to tell you a parable that is called the sower, where he says the kingdom of heaven is like the sower who sows the seeds, and some of them fall on the path, and the birds eat them, and some of them fall in rocky soil, and they don't really get big roots, but they start to grow, but then they can't keep growing because the roots don't go deep enough. And some of them go to where the thorns are, and the thorns and weeds choke them out, and then some of them fall on good soil and become good plants. So that's what on earth could that mean about the kingdom of heaven? I think it's about, Jake, did you have something to say? The more people who come to heaven, the bigger it gets. You know, I think all of these kind of point to different things. I mean, I think if we think about that idea of beloved community, some of the things, like with the sower, some of the things that we do to make that come into being, some of the ways that we spread our love don't seem to work. And some of them seem to work really well. And sometimes we don't know what's going to get choked out by weeds, what's going to get eaten by birds, and what's going to turn into good things. So there are a lot of lessons about this, about what that might mean, about what the kingdom of heaven might mean, how it spreads from a small thing to a great thing, how there are different ways that it may play out in the world. But those are some of the lessons about the kingdom of heaven that Jesus taught. And so now you all can go to your classes. Offertory that we collect each week is a way of us embodying that we are one and that we give to one another and to the larger community. And so we'll now take an offering for the ongoing support of the congregation. We are all heretics in the eyes of those who do not share our views. Let us be tolerant toward one another and let no one condemn another's belief. So wrote Sebastian Castillo in the 16th century, following the martyrdom of Michael Servetus. Now, we count Servetus among our UU martyrs because he was burned at the stake for rejection of Christian doctrines like the Trinity. A friend and colleague of mine who grew up Mennonite says that she spent much of her time in Sunday school learning about Mennonite martyrs. They had a few of them in the same time period. We actually grew out of similar roots of the Radical Reformation. Now, often we recount our UU history as beginning in this country as the Calvinist churches of the Puritans and Pilgrims split in the early 19th century over doctrines of inherent depravity. But actually, our Unitarian history goes back quite a bit longer into the Radical Reformation. Unitarian churches continue to survive in Hungary and Romania, deeply influenced by that Radical Reformation, and through the centuries persecuted by Catholics, Protestants, and Communists. So, we have roots in common with the Mennonites. Like them, we early on rejected the idea of infant baptism, insisting on believers or adult baptism. And like them, we set aside creeds and over time have held common views on many social justice issues. Here in Manhattan, we have cooperated through the Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice, and Richard and his wife and co-pastor Barbara are among the clergy who supported the LGBT anti-discrimination ordinance along with us. Of course, we don't agree on everything, which is why we invited Richard to speak, to learn more about the Mennonite tradition, so that we can better work together. And I close my words this morning with a quote from another 16th century Unitarian, Francis David: "You need not think alike to love alike." So may it be. Our hymn is number 298, "Wake Now My Senses."
I'm reading from Micah. "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?"
You have heard that it was said, "An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth." But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rains on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect.
Well, it is a privilege to be here with you this morning, and I bring you greetings from your neighbors at Manhattan Mennonite Church. There are several of you I certainly know from various other settings over the years that I've been here, and I've been to a number of events in this building, but I'm usually otherwise occupied on a Sunday morning. So we decided, you know, for once at least we could, since my wife and I share the position, I'm here today while she's covering responsibilities over at the Mennonite Church today. So there's a lot of places I go where I know people are confused when I tell them that I'm a Mennonite pastor. I can tell they're trying to figure out, you know, like where I park my horse or something. Our denomination, Mennonite Church USA, has a website, thirdway.com. It's an information website that tries to explain who we are and some of the different varieties among Mennonites and Amish and that sort of thing. And people can submit questions to that to have them answered. And there's some pretty interesting ones that get submitted from time to time. Of course, there's a lot of people that want to know, where can I buy one of those bonnets, or things like... Are the Mennonites related to the Moabites in the Bible? Or... Well, I know this is a more sophisticated audience than that. I did check up this past week when I was preparing for this to see what John Alou had put in the newsletter for your fellowship about my coming here and what it said. And she said in there that we as Mennonites are known for our commitment to peace and justice. And she wrote that, like UUs, we are non-creedal, we share a covenant, however, they remain firm in their commitment to Jesus. That's actually a pretty good, accurate summary. Thanks, John Alou. It's actually better than some of the things that sometimes we Mennonites try to say in explaining who we are. I remember a number of years ago, I was invited to do a lecture at a Baptist seminary about Mennonites, and shortly before I did that, I happened to be meeting with my conference minister, and he said to me, well, you probably shouldn't tell them what I often tell people. And of course, I asked, well, what do you tell people? And he said, well, I tell them that we're a lot like Baptists, except we don't kill people. I didn't tell him that. And I hope we can go a little bit deeper than that here, too. So I want to start a little bit with just a very brief history lesson. John Alou already alluded to the Radical Reformation. A little context for that, of course, this year, as many of you probably know, is the 500th anniversary of the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther formally breaking with the Catholic Church at that time. And after Luther then was successful in his break and in forming a new church, there were a number of other reformers all across Europe. Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich, John Calvin in Geneva, John Knox in Scotland, Thomas Cranmer and others in England, all broke and all started their own churches. But keep in mind, that didn't mean that the average person actually got to choose what church they went to. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, you'd have a town with a Catholic church on one corner and a Lutheran church across the street and Reformed church, you know, down the block somewhere. No, it was up to the ruler of every area, and so every kingdom or duchy or city-state or whatever it was, the rulers would decide what church existed in that territory, and if you lived there, then you were a member of that church, whether you wanted to be or not. Well, as the Reformation spread and grew then, there were increasingly these people who were wanting to push and go even further in the Reformation. And in fact, some of these folks didn't even talk about a Reformation. They talked about a restoration. They wanted to restore the original intent of the church as outlined by Jesus and his very first followers. And these are the folks then who became known as the Radical Reformation. And they faced opposition from all of the various state churches that were in existence. And again, for a number of these radical reformers, one of the key issues over which the conflict came to a head was the issue of baptism. Now, baptism at that time was something that was done to infants when they were only a few days old, and parents would bring their child to the church. They would be baptized and really would be recognized as a person at that point. They would get a name, they would become a part of the church, and they'd become a citizen as well of whatever territory they were living in. Well, as some of the folks then were looking to restore the practice of the early church and rereading the New Testament, they came to an understanding of baptism as something that is to be a step that is made when one makes a conscious decision to be a follower of Jesus. And obviously that's not something that an infant can do. And so they began to argue for a change in practice or what they call believer's baptism, sometimes called adult baptism as well. Well, virtually all of the state churches were opposed to this idea. I mean, infant baptism was heavily ingrained. It had been the tradition for well over 1,000 years at this point. And from a very practical standpoint, it was pretty useful to the state as well. As a way of keeping track of who all the citizens were and, of course, who all the taxpayers were in their area. But a few of these radical reformers then began to baptize one another in defiance of laws that made this practice illegal. The first recorded baptism that we have of this, from which we sort of date the beginning of the movement, the official beginning, was in January of 1525 in the city of Zurich. Now, there may have been other groups in other places that were doing this around the same time, but that's the first one we know of. And state churches all across Europe very quickly denounced these radicals as heretics. And they were given the name Anabaptists, which means rebaptizers. They'd all been baptized as infants, were rebaptizing each other as adults. Now, they didn't see themselves as rebaptizing because they didn't think what happened to them as babies was really a baptism. So they didn't like that term, but it was the name that got given to them, and it stuck. And so you'll still hear or read references to Anabaptist theology, Anabaptist beliefs today. In fact, the seminary where I have my Master's of Divinity from is now known as Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary. So we have indeed claimed that. Sometimes people even refer to themselves as Anabaptist rather than as Mennonite to try and avoid some of that confusion we often get with our Amish cousins. But it can also lead to other misunderstandings. People often hear anti-Baptist, and we have to explain, no, we're not against the Baptists either. So, well, for the first decade or so of this Anabaptist movement, it was hard to really define what it was all about. It was a very loose conglomeration of folks. It was heavily persecuted. And so anytime a leader would arise, they would be arrested, imprisoned, in many cases put to death. And so it was hard to know what they were really all about. Some of the folks in the movement were pacifists. Others were quite violent. Most of them, you know, were opposed to any sort of state church. Some of them actually, though, a few, tried to establish their own state church in certain areas. Eventually, then, there was a former Catholic priest in the Netherlands who became part of the movement, the Anabaptist movement. And he was able to give some significant leadership to the group over a period of several decades. And it was a man named Menno Simons. Menno somehow managed to elude arrest, and he traveled widely. He wrote extensively. There's a book about yay thick, The Complete Writings of Menno Simons, that we have in our church library today. And because of the leadership then that he was able to give and create this more complete and more consistent vision, many of the groups soon became known as Mennonists or Mennonites. It's the name that was given. Again, not a name they chose for themselves. And many of them said, no, didn't like it because they said, we're not following Menno, we're trying to follow Jesus. But it's the name that we still use today. So Mennonites are now the largest Anabaptist group that's still in existence. There are other groups. There are folks like the Hutterites who practice communal living, and that they developed separately, also going back to the time of the Radical Reformation. There are the Brethren, who formed about 200 years after the Reformation out of the Pietist movement. And, of course, there's the Amish, a group that actually split away from the Mennonites in the late 17th century. Mennonite World Conference today counts about 2.1 million Mennonites, Amish, and Hutterites all around the world. About two-thirds of those, by the way, are in the global south, mostly Africa and Asia. So that's a little bit of history, where Mennonites come from, where you can find us today. So what is it defines us? What does it mean to be a Mennonite? Well, as I said earlier, we're a non-creedal church. We also don't have a strong hierarchy that tells us what we need to do, what we need to believe. And so that question of who is a Mennonite is one that probably has about as many different answers as there are Mennonites. So a few disclaimers here to start with. Manhattan Mennonite Church here, we are part of Mennonite Church USA, which is the largest Anabaptist group in this country. And I think it's pretty safe to say it's also the most progressive of all of those. Within Mennonite Church USA, and by the way, there's about 40 different Mennonite groups in the United States right now. Mennonite Church USA, then, is made up of 19 different area conferences, and I'm not sure how many hundreds of congregations, and there's some significant differences, again, between the policies and practices of the different area conferences and the different congregations within those. Again, Manhattan Mennonite is part of Western District Conference, which covers basically Kansas down to Texas, and is, again, one of the more progressive of those 19 area conferences. So all of that is to say that my answer of that question of who is a Mennonite is going to be different than what you might hear from many other Mennonites if you would ask that. But with all of those disclaimers, then there are certain few things that we often use to talk about the fundamental points of Mennonite belief and practice that most Mennonites would agree to. There's a noted historian, was dean of a seminary named Harold S. Bender, who wrote a paper back in 1944. It's called The Anabaptist Vision, a little booklet like this. And in this paper, he sort of boiled the essence of Anabaptism, Mennonite faith, down to three essential points. And that was back in 1944, like I said. His work has sort of been the standard ever since. His work, though, has now been updated a little bit more and reframed somewhat in 2008 when another retired Mennonite pastor, educator, missionary, a man named Palmer Becker put out this little booklet called What is an Anabaptist Christian? And so certainly within Mennonite Church USA, at least, if you ask the question of what is a Mennonite, this is sort of the standard that you'll get today. And Becker then makes three essential statements to describe what he calls the Anabaptist distinctives. And his first statement is, Jesus is the center of our faith. Now, that seems like sort of an obvious thing that pretty much anybody who calls himself a Christian would agree to. But for many Christians, when we're talking about Jesus, they're talking almost exclusively about his death. In fact, if you look at the classic creeds of the church, you'll see that they talk about the virgin birth of Jesus, and then they jump immediately to his suffering and crucifixion. And they skip over entirely everything that he said, and everything that he did in between there. Mennonites, though, focus on that, on the life and the teachings of Jesus. We don't think that Jesus just came to die, that his sole purpose is to come and perform some sort of transaction on the cross to pay for our sins so we can all go to heaven someday. Now we do believe in an afterlife, yes, but we also believe that Jesus came to show us how to live here and now. And that kingdom of heaven that John Lee was talking about with the kids is present among us as well. It's not just some other place, some other sphere, some other time. I would say that Jesus is both the fullest revelation of the divine and also the best model for what it means to live a fully human life. And so for Mennonites, in reading the Bible, and the Bible is very important to us, but we don't read it as a flat document where every chapter and every verse has exactly equal weight. We place more emphasis on the Gospels, the part where the words and the actions of Jesus are recorded, and everything else in the Bible then is read through that lens of Jesus. A Mennonite theologian named J. Denny Weaver, for example, he writes about the Bible as an ongoing conversation with multiple perspectives and contradictory images of God. Now, I should hasten to add, there are many Mennonites who probably would be offended by that idea that there are contradictory images in the Bible, but this is Weaver. And he says that that Jesus, then, is the arbiter. He's the one who has the final word over which perspectives, which images of God are the genuine ones. And so, within the Bible, then, the most complete summary of Jesus' teachings are probably found in chapters 5 through 7 of the Gospel of Matthew, what is often referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. And you heard a portion of that read this morning. For Mennonites, then, these three chapters really are the core of the entire Bible. And so we read this morning about that part about Jesus talking about loving one's enemies and turning the other cheek and some of those things. For us, these statements of Jesus, then, take priority over all those passages where God might be portrayed as condoning violence or demanding bloodshed, because Jesus is the center of our faith. So that's the first statement. The second statement, then, is that community is the center of our lives. Again, for a lot of Christians, being a Christian is all about my relationship, my individual relationship with God. It's about, you know, personal salvation, seeking forgiveness for the things that I have done, again, so that I can go to heaven someday. Again, for Mennonites, it's not that we don't believe in personal salvation or don't believe in an afterlife, but we believe that forgiveness is something that needs to be lived out within the community of faith, here and now, to be that beloved community. There's a story, for example, about an Amish man who's visited by some evangelist who's going around knocking on doors, and he asks this Amish man, "Are you saved?" And his response is, "Go ask my neighbor." The idea is, of course, that if I am truly reconciled with God, then it will be apparent in the ways that I live, the ways that I interact with others. A quote that I often use is that faith is always personal, but never private. My faith isn't just a matter of holding to a certain set of ideals, performing certain religious acts. My faith is lived out in the public sphere, how I treat others. And the church, then, the community of faith, is in a sense the laboratory where we learn to live in relationship with each other so that we can then live that way in the broader world as well. Another important aspect, then, of this Mennonite emphasis on community is the need for communal discernment and interpretation of Scripture. So as a Mennonite pastor, I certainly have certain training in biblical studies. I have a particular role in congregational leadership, but my role is not to tell everybody else what they need to believe and what they need to do. My responsibility is to gather with others in the church to study and to discern together. Here's an example of this. A few years ago, Mennonite Church USA had an initiative that was known as the 12 Scriptures Project. And every congregation within Mennonite Church USA was encouraged to go through a process to determine the 12 most significant or formative passages of Scripture for that particular community. Now, the two texts that you heard read this morning out of the prophet Micah and the Gospel of Matthew, those are two of the texts that Manhattan Mennonite Church chose out of that process. And actually, I should say that in looking at what some other churches have chosen, every church that I've seen that has gone through this process chose that Micah passage as well. That's sort of a great statement of what we believe church is about, doing justice, loving kindness, walking humbly with God. And they also at least chose something from the Sermon on the Mount, whether it was that particular passage or the entire sermon or something like that. In a sense, though, the point is not to... The point isn't what scriptures are chosen. The point is to engage together in the process. And so what we did, every person was invited to come together in a small group setting somewhere and to talk about their own favorite passages, what's most important to them. Each small group came up with their lists, and then in those small groups, then we came together in a congregational meeting, had all of them listed, and then we talked. We had to go through all and listen to each other and share with each other and narrow that down ultimately to 12. And in the end, I have to tell you, two of my all-time favorite texts in entire Scripture didn't make it into the 12. Because in the end, I as a pastor had no more say in that process than that 14 or 15-year-old youth who wasn't even baptized yet but wanted to engage and have their say. Because community is the center of our life. Finally, then, the third statement that Becker makes is that reconciliation is the center of our work. And in a sense, really, this is just a practical application of that first statement about Jesus being the center of our faith, because Jesus' entire life is about reconciliation. Through Jesus, God was at work reconciling all of creation to God's self. And because Jesus is the center of our faith, we then continue that work of reconciliation that Jesus initiated. Following Jesus is all about having right reconciled relationships, a right relationship with ourselves, a right relationship with God, a right relationship with our neighbors, a right relationship with all of creation. Now, for most people who know anything about Mennonites, beyond those stereotypes about the beards and the buggies and bonnets and so on, the first thing that they probably think of is peace. We are known as one of the historic peace churches, along with the Brethren's and the Society of Friends, or the Quakers. And here in the United States, those three churches are ones that have worked together in times of military conscription, providing opportunities for young men to serve the country in alternative ways, nonviolent ways. Now, I grew up hearing stories from my father. My father was lucky enough to get drafted at the very end of World War II, and then again during the Korean War. And in both cases, he served as a conscientious objector in non-military ways. He served, and so I heard him talking about his experiences working for the National Forest Service and the Soil Conservation Service and the Topeka State Mental Hospital. Those were very formative for me in shaping my own understanding of who Jesus is and what it means to follow in his way. And over the past several generations, I would say that our Mennonite understanding of peace has expanded some from not only saying no in certain circumstances and not participating in the military, but to seeking for nonviolent alternatives to work towards reconciliation in many different areas. And if you peruse Mennonite-related websites today, you'll find information and resources on such broad topics as immigration policy, Israel-Palestine, gun violence, Standing Rock, PTSD among veterans, prevention of sexual abuse, racism, and on and on. All of these are areas of concern for us as a church because reconciliation is the center of our work. So that's my answer to what is a Mennonite. Now, we are far from a perfect church, and I would never claim that we have achieved the goal of some of those early Anabaptists who sought for a restoration of the original church as it was fully envisioned by Jesus and his first followers. But we continue to work together to build a better world, to live as more authentic followers of Jesus, as we try to make Jesus the center of our faith, to live in community as a center of our lives, and to carry out reconciliation as a center of our work. So I think we've got a little time for some questions yet, if people would like to hear more. And John Lou, you'll just have to tell me when to sit down, or somebody. Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I had no idea there were so many similarities between the two churches, and it was really interesting and helpful, so thank you.
I have a question on the 12 verses or something. Yeah. Did the Beatitudes make it in, or?
Yes.
They did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the Beatitudes was, again, one of the biggest controversies that we had in making the final decision of the 12 scriptures is whether to include the entire Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, which begins with the Beatitudes, or to just include sections of it. We included sections. We actually have three different passages: the Beatitudes, the text you heard read this morning, and the Lord's Prayer. All three are within the Sermon on the Mount.
So. What's most Mennonites' view on participating in civil government, state governments?
Yeah, you'll find a lot of variation across the church on that. Speaking for the group that I'm mostly part of, which can be defined a lot of different ways, but Western District Conference of Mennonite Church USA, there's a lot of participation. I mean, most of us certainly vote, contact legislators and that sort of thing. We've had officials as well. I can't think of any right now, but oftentimes there have been state legislators in Topeka that are Mennonite. Many of you may be familiar with Dwayne Gosin, who was budget director for a number of years under several governors, Graves, Sebelius. He's a member of Southern Hills Mennonite Church in Topeka and was a legislator before that grew up Mennonite. So we certainly have been involved in various ways. Again, there are churches and sects that you would go to where there would be little to no participation, including not voting. So that varies quite a bit. Actually, in Canada, there have even been cabinet ministers that are part of the Mennonite Church. So.
Hi. A few days ago, my wife Judy and I met someone who taught as a school teacher in Quinter, Kansas, for a few years, and he said that community was populated by people who were Brethren. So what is the difference between the Brethren group or church and the Mennonites?
Yeah, I'm not entirely qualified to answer that question. I'm aware of Quinter as one of the centers for Church of the Brethren. Abilene would be the closest one here as well. So the Church of the Brethren claims Anabaptist roots, so it would be similar ones, but it really comes out of the Pietist movement, which came along about almost 200 years later. So there's this may be unfair, but when we talk about when I talked about the three distinctives of Mennonites, about Jesus being the center of our faith, community center of our life, and reconciliation center of our work, I think that second one for Brethren would be not as strong. It's more of based on personal salvation, not as strong of the sense of community. But again, that's my perception of it. It's maybe an unfair. Yes. Yes, absolutely. There would be a lot of definitely are again part of the historic peace churches, and there's an annual, for example, an annual event that's held at colleges. I'm trying to remember the name of the group. They just met at Bethel College down here in Newton, which is my alma mater, this past spring. But it includes, I know it includes both Brethren colleges and Mennonite colleges. So McPherson College down in McPherson would be a Brethren school, for example.
I am wondering a couple of things. I'll just start with one of them. There are, by my personal experience, almost as many former Unitarian Universalists as there are current ones. And I suspect, and I have known, I grew up in a community that had a lot of Mennonites, but many left. What kinds of things typically cause people to decide that they no longer want to be part of a Mennonite community or church?
Yeah, wow. If I could answer that question, we'd probably be a larger congregation here. So, again, some historical things that have led to that is probably until about World War II, Mennonites tended to be a much more separatist group. So, for example, a community I grew up in, Mound Ridge, Kansas, a lot of Mennonites there. The congregation I grew up in was still worshiping in German at least once a month all the way through World War II. Even though, the immigration that founded that church was back in 1874, and they immigrated from Russia, not from Germany. So they had maintained this separate identity that entire time. And so the church was, even when I was growing up there, it was a large congregation, 700-800 members. Three-fourths of those probably had one of five last names. It was largely an ethnic sort of identity, family identity. People might go away for school, for training, but they would come back and settle. That started changing after World War II, in part as just a lot of different things that happened. So being Mennonite today is not as defined by family, blood ties, culture, if you will. Manhattan Mennonite Church, we're pretty much half and half as far as how many of us are people who grew up in the Mennonite church and people who did not. As people have moved out of those more closed ethnic communities, many have chosen to engage in other ways, have gone, they go to other churches, they go to no church. We've had to redefine what I would say is we've had to redefine what we mean when we say community is a center of our faith, because community for so long was defined along family lines, and there are still those who do that today, and it frankly is one of my pet peeves when people start defining Mennonites in terms of how we're related to one another, because I don't think that's the essence of who we are. So I don't know if I answered your question at all, but those are some thoughts that I have, and the differences and the difficulties of maintaining that Mennonite identity in a more pluralistic sort of setting.
Is the Manhattan congregation involved in the social justice initiative to change the doctrine of discovery or revoke it?
Yes, we are. The So Mennonite Central Committee, which is our relief and development organization that works among a variety of different Mennonite groups, continues to do a lot of work with the Doctrine of Discovery. And we actually did host this, I think it was last fall, wasn't it? I can't remember. Right. Yes, Erica Littlewolf. It was held over at Ecumenical Campus Ministries, but we really were the sponsoring organization that brought that activity. It's called Loss of Turtle Island, where they go through and talk about how Native Americans have been pushed off and marginalized and frankly killed, many of them. So yeah, that's definitely something that we are aware of and have done some work on.
I was just wondering how the Mennonite Church views or incorporates or doesn't incorporate other religious faiths completely different from or outside of Christianity, such as Buddhism, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not quite sure how to answer that one either. It would vary a lot from one place to another. We still clearly identify ourselves as Christian, and in many ways are fairly orthodox. We are Trinitarian. We are, a lot of those sorts of things. So as far as incorporating, you would not typically have, for example, any texts other than the Bible being read as the basis for a message in a Mennonite service. Again, we certainly work with in our relief and development work. Certainly work with non-Christian groups. For example, again, going back to Mennonite Central Committee, I know that they've been involved in rebuilding Buddhist temples in Vietnam, for example. So we certainly work with other groups, and there are Christian relief groups I know that specifically target and only give relief to Christians. That's never been our policy at all. So we work with that as far as actually incorporating them into the same body. That's a bit different. So I don't know if that answers you.
Hi, I'm Kristen Corwin. When I was growing up, I only knew one thing about Mennonites, and that was that my mother had had a roommate in college, this would have been mid-60s, who was very good at math and science, but could not be an engineer because she was Mennonite, and there was restrictions on the areas of that she could, what she could do. She could be a nurse, or she could. Now, of course, there were many women who had these restrictions anyway. So I don't want this to sound like how can I get a bonnet, but I'm trying to understand the different gradations of what it means to be Mennonite and the standing of women in the Mennonite church that you are part of today. Thank you.
Sure. So let me say, first of all, so this was the 60s you were saying, and this woman couldn't be an engineer? Okay. Had she been a member of the congregation I grew up in, that wouldn't have been an issue. Okay. That probably would have been true pretty much anywhere in Western District Conference. Of what is now Mennonite Church USA. So that's one of those things that would be different depending on where you're from. But the role of women in the church is still one of the controversial things. And when I said earlier that Western District Conference that we're a part of here is one of the more progressive of Mennonite Church Area conferences, that's exactly one of the issues where you can see that, is that we probably have the highest percentage of female pastors of any of the conferences of Mennonite Church USA. We were the first conference to have a female be the conference minister overseeing the entire conference. I meet monthly with pastors, the Mennonite pastors in Northeast Kansas. There's five of us extending from Salina to Kansas City, five churches, that is. Every one of those churches has a woman on staff. There's two of us, Topeka and Manhattan, where it's a husband-wife team. So for this part of the Mennonite church, there's a lot of openness to and affirmation, not just openness, affirmation for women serving in whatever roles. There would still be parts of Mennonite Church USA where that would be difficult. In fact, a few months ago, my wife and I were candidates for a position at a congregation out in Virginia. We thought we were going to be leaving Manhattan. We went out and candidated and did our whole and thought we were going to be moving there. And when they took the vote, there was a much larger than we expected vote in opposition to us. And we chose not to go there. And it was at least in part because some of those who were opposed to us coming there did not want a woman in the pulpit. Even though we would be sharing the position, she would be, I mean, what we've been doing here for the last number of years is pretty much half and half, you know, every almost, not exactly, but pretty much every other week, having the responsibilities in the pulpit. That congregation, and we were surprised by that, because that was not, again, that was not what the leadership of the congregation reflected. It was not the majority of the congregation, but it was a large enough minority that we decided we didn't want to go. So that's still a controversy.
I'm going to take the privilege of the last question.
All right.
The Sermon on the Mount has been a very significant piece for me, and I've struggled with it a lot. The nonviolence, you know, particularly the part that Chris read today, that's really, really hard stuff spiritually. And I wonder if you could say anything about the struggle of nonviolence.
Yeah. Right. Again, it was a lot easier when we were a more separatist group. We just withdrew, didn't get involved in larger sort of state issues, which didn't mean that there was no violence in the community. So, for example, the congregation I grew up in, which is a wonderful place to grow up, was a result of a church division that happened back in the 1890s, and it was a deep division. And we don't really know what the argument was about, because there was actually a lawsuit at the time, and when the lawsuit was settled out of court, one of the provisions was that all the documents would be destroyed and nobody involved in it could ever talk about it again. So so we haven't always been really... Was that nonviolent? Well, yes. I mean, nobody came to blows, but yeah. It was not what we would... hope to do today in terms of reconciliation and that sort of thing. There's a lot of the discussion that's happening these days about nonviolence too. Then is where, what are the boundaries? What is nonviolent? Where do you cross the line? Back when Bender wrote his article in 1944, they didn't even talk about nonviolence. They talked about non-resistance, which is drawing on the words that you heard read this morning. Jesus said, do not resist. And that was largely a passive, non-involvement sort of thing. And as Mennonites, again, have become more acculturated and gotten more involved in the world, we recognize we can't just do that. To simply withdraw and ignore the injustices is to allow them to continue. It is a struggle to know how then to respond, when to respond, where those lines are
what exactly is nonviolent, and when does nonviolence become violent, or non-participation become simply blessing the violence or allowing it to continue? Those are a lot of the things that still get talked about and discussed today. So that's some of the struggle where we're at right now.
Okay, let's sing. Number 170, We Are a Gentle Angry People. Universalist Hosea Ballou, if we agree in love, then there's no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. Go in peace.